Hello and welcome to another all-new Salt and Light Hour. I'm Deacon Pedro.
Whether we like it or not, people are going to come to the United States because we've been telling them to come here for a century. So what we need to now do is understand that that's a reality, and we need to work on creating a coherent system that can actually accommodate people.
That's our guest, Nathaniel Lezra, speaking about migration. Nathaniel Lezra is the director and executive producer of a new documentary film, Roads of Fire, which examines the global migration crisis as it interweaves the lives of a human smuggler, an asylum seeker, and workers in the front lines of a humanitarian emergency. We're going to be speaking with Nathaniel Lezra in about 5 minutes, so you don't want to miss that. And right after, our book contributor, Jermaine Bagnell, is back to give us two new book suggestions for your Christmas shopping list. That's in about 20 minutes. And then
I find for me personally, when I write songs, it's only kind of write if I feel like maybe I have something to say or something on my mind. And the songs that came out of this EP, As I Wait, were all kind of just different prayers and reflections that I've, you know, had just experiencing just in my journey of faith, and thought, hey, maybe, you know, I can kind of write these down. Like literally a lot of the times the lyrics would come through in prayer or adoration or things like that. So felt just, yeah, I should kind of share these in the hope that it might be able to relate to others as well.
That's the voice of our featured artist this week, Gabriel Jamaria, a multi-instrumentalist, musician, and producer based in Hamilton, Ontario, who's been making music since he's 5 years old. He's performed all over North America, and he says that his mission is to spread happiness through music. He has a new album that is a reflection of his Catholic faith, so we're going to be meeting Gabriel Jamaria in about 25 minutes. Be sure to download the Salt and Light Plus app. That's the best place to listen to this program so you don't miss one single episode. Very soon, we're going to be speaking about the migration crisis. But first, here's our featured artist of the week, Gabriel Jamaria, with No More from his new album, As I Wait.
I had fallen too many times to count. Count them I did, by your grace and your help. Man, it was painful, but I long to be released, saying, bless me, Father, I have sinned. It's been so many weeks, and one by one you knock them down. You take away my sins, you turn my life around. Your love's worth living for. Help me to go and sin no more. So I went walking along the path you made, but then I went. Calling out to me, gathered me in your arms. You helped me to see, by the blood of your cross pouring down. You wash away my sins, you turn my life around. 'Cause your love's worth living for. Help me to go and sin. Been holding on too long, yet somehow you release me from it all. By the blood of your cross pouring down, wash away my sins.
We're listening to Gabriel Jamaria with No More from his new album, As I Wait. We're going to be speaking with Gabriel Jamaria in about 20 minutes, so stay tuned. The global migration statistics are staggering. As of mid-2024, there were an estimated 304 million international migrants worldwide. That's double from what it was in 1990. The number of forcibly displaced people was 122 million. That includes 83 million internally displaced people, 44 million refugees and asylum seekers, and 73,000 missing migrants. The new documentary, Roads of Fire, looks at the global migration crisis, the challenges faced by migrants, the reality of the human smuggling trade, and the humanitarian efforts to help. To find out more, earlier this week, I spoke with the film's director, Nathaniel Lezra. I started by asking him how the whole idea for the film came about.
I look at it from a couple different perspectives. So one is a personal perspective. My grandfather, as a teenager, fled during the Spanish Civil War. He was a secular kid. He was a teenager. He was thrown into a concentration camp, and he and his family escaped and had to flee to Morocco, where they started with nothing again as refugees, as locals, and in Tangier. So, you know, there's a history of fleeing and of exoduses in my family, which I think ties me to the subject. Mm-hmm. I think that from a more practical standpoint, you know, the film really just came about because of proximity. You know, I was finishing my previous film, which also focused on refugee stories. It was about teenage Ukrainian refugees. And we were finishing the film in Midtown just as the first waves of the buses that were being sent from Texas to New York were arriving. So we would finish our day working and we'd get out in the streets of Midtown and we would just be surrounded by this influx of migrants and asylum seekers. And so initially it was just that proximity of every day seeing these people, wondering who they were, wondering where they were coming from. It was an incredibly multicultural group of people. So that was also really interesting to me. It was lots of Latin American immigrants, but also mm-hmm. people from the Middle East, people, you know, from West Africa. And so I got really curious just based on that proximity, who these people were and what their stories were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds really interesting. And that part is also featured in the documentary. So it's almost like a cast of different characters. I think everybody's probably interested in the human smuggler. How did you make that connection?
Sure. So he was an interesting guy to get in touch with. We have a really passionate and wonderfully talented subject producer. She's in Caracas, Venezuela. She is just a humanitarian worker, but she had a family member who had been smuggled out of Venezuela. So this person had been smuggled out by Jonathan. So she knew Jonathan through her cousin.
Okay.
And so when she heard what we were trying to accomplish and that we were trying to give, you know, use the film as this holistic document that explains to people, you know, what are the contexts from which people are fleeing? How do they flee? What do they rely on when they are in the act of fleeing? And what do they experience once they get to their destination? Once she heard that, she sort of was like, look, you need to get in touch with Jonathan. This man is one of the people that gets people out, right? He gets people out of these dicey places that have collapsed, that are undergoing mm-hmm. war. And he's a really complicated person. He sort of regards himself as a kind of gangster Robin Hood. He is cartel affiliated, as one must be when you're in that industry. But he's also a really, you know, he's got a family and he's an empathetic guy. So he was an interesting person to work with. And we were very lucky to get in touch with him.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And the contrast between the work that he's doing as a Robin Hood, I like that mm-hmm. term, and the people, let's say in New York City, that are receiving them, or in Texas that are receiving them, those volunteers, or Father Lopez, yeah. who's also featured in the film. So you were in Venezuela. Did you get to follow kind of that route through Panama or through the Darién?
Sure. Sure. So yeah. we went down to the border with Venezuela. So I was told by the, you know, by the embassy and by various other people, the actual pathways to get into Venezuela would have been really complicated for me as an mm-hmm. American. Mm-hmm. You know, if I had my Spanish passport, I could have potentially gone in as a Spaniard, because I'm half Spanish. But getting to that border, to the Simón Bolívar Bridge, getting to the edge of Colombia, we immediately were working with people who were fleeing. So we tracked it from that initial point up to the Darien. So we got right up to the beginning of the jungle. The cartel eventually stopped us from going any deeper. We had intended to. But we covered all of Colombia. We got into Panama. We did about a day of the jungle path.
Yeah. That's a crazy place. So I grew up in Panama. That's why I'm so familiar with the region. And I remember growing up all my life, and we would always question, like, why is there no road between Panama and Colombia? And it's because the jungle is so dense that it's just physically impossible. And I don't know why it still seems to be impossible. And yet there are, I don't know what the final statistic was in terms of, you know, hundreds of thousands of refugees that are crossing in through that jungle and dying in that jungle into a country that does not have the resources to support them. And many of these refugees, again, so that people understand, Nathaniel, they're not Venezuelan. They might be coming from Africa, right?
Absolutely.
Through Venezuela to Colombia or through Haiti or whatever. Like, that's just, did you meet anybody who you'd say, like, wow, like that person, and they made it all the way to El Paso, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, that was true of so many people that I met. One of the important things to understand about Venezuela is that there's a direct flight from Iran to Venezuela. So many, many, many of the people that we encountered were from the Middle East or West Africa. And so it would be, you know, someone fleeing Syria. They go Syria to Iran, Iran to Brazil, and then Brazil up to Venezuela. And then that's where they begin their footpath. Often their footpath begins in Brazil. So we're talking about people who walk for 6 months.
Insane.
Yeah.
Insane.
Buses to walk. Yeah.
And when you met these people, because I think that somebody might be listening thinking, like, how bad are things in your country that you actually would be willing to walk for 6 months through the jungle or through Central America? And in your meeting with them, you'd say, yes, this is better than staying at home.
Well, everybody would say something different relative to that. But the overwhelming consensus is, and what international law dictates, is that if there's a provable and a reasonable fear of death in your home country and you flee, that qualifies you as a refugee, and therefore the diplomatic protections of a refugee status. So taking Venezuela as an example, it's a place where the infrastructure is so completely eviscerated, and where there's so much violence over because of the desperation of the conditions, that the simple act of walking to school is dangerous to the point that it can be a mortal fear. So people are starving in that place. People are there's a high kidnapping rate. I mean, these are the conditions that create a situation where people make the calculus that it might be better to be on the road, come what may, brave the jungle, and go through the process of asylum in a country that is hostile to you, rather than risk dying of starvation or dying of, you know, being abducted or executed in the streets because you're from a different ethnic background than the one currently in power, as is the case in different parts of the Middle East.
Yeah. Would you say then that some of these people are sold a story of, I mean, obviously, given what you've described, life in North America would be better, but maybe that they have a misplaced idea of what that life in North America could be? Like, are they being told the truth about that?
Well, this is a really great, this is a central question to the thesis of the film. I think that our film is in many ways about that story. And what the question that our country, the United States, needs to face is about narrative and about story. What is the story that we are telling the world? What is the mythology that we're building about our country? You know, the Conservative Party and the progressive parties alike over the last century have sold the world this idea that this the United States is a land of immigrants for immigrants, and that our arms are open, and that we're a sanctuary place for people. Give us your sick, your meek, your poor, etc. And the reality is that we have a system that, you know, I like to say that it's not that we have a broken system. It's that what we're seeing is an absence of a system. There is no system. Mm-hmm. What we have is a place where our politics have gotten so divisive and so toxic that we use refugees as pawns in our political squabbles. But in terms of the actual act of receiving people, there is no meaningful infrastructure. There is no meaningful ways of delivering upon that story, right? So people flee and they come to our borders and they're, you know, detained, they're jailed, and then they're paroled into the country. But, you know, as you see documented in the film, many of them have no idea what cities their court appointments are in. They're given papers in languages they don't understand. There's no relationship between ICE, federal authorities, the local police departments, local housing departments, much less any sort of national system. These are all agencies and organizations that have nothing to do with one another and barely communicate. So what we see is people arriving in these cities completely confused, completely disoriented, speaking languages that are not reflected by the people who do work in this country. And 6 weeks later are being told that they're going to be sent back to Afghanistan or to Syria or to now any arbitrary country who will take them because they didn't file their application on time when no one told them that there even was a deadline. No one communicated to them in Spanish that they had to be at this a courthouse in Jacksonville, Florida, rather than in New York. Mm-hmm. Right. So this is a culture and an environment that exists because of a lack of a system, a lack of a plan to deliver on that story. So to your original question, I think that our country really needs to make a decision about who we want to be in the world. Are we going to actually be there for people? Are we going to live up to that promise? Or are we going to continue down the path of, I guess, isolationism and hostility? One of the first things I encountered down south was that story is incredibly potent and incredibly meaningful to people. They believe it on a really, really core level. And that has to be respected. So whether we like it or not, people are going to come to the United States because we've been telling them to come here for a century. So what we need to now do is understand that that's a reality. And we need to work on creating a coherent system that can actually accommodate people.
Yeah. And I guess, I don't know if you started already working on this before the current administration. Would you say that no matter what the administrations, that the United States for the last 10, 15 years has been struggling with this?
Absolutely.
So again, just to make it clear that we're not pointing any fingers at any particular administration.
Yeah, I think it's really important to actually voice that. You know, this is a film that I think is fundamentally bipartisan insofar as it doesn't really participate in partisan politics. This isn't a gotcha film against conservatives or a gotcha film against the left. If there is an antagonist in this film, it's a Democrat. Eric Adams, his administration was the administration that failed the immigrants and refugees who came to New York and forced the volunteers to step up. So I think that it's an issue, and this goes back to this idea of story. It's an issue of storytelling on both sides. Who are we? Who do we want to be in the world? And that's a Democratic problem, a Republican problem. It's a problem that needs to be solved by both parties together.
Mm-hmm. You started off by saying that you have a personal connection to the whole kind of refugee or immigrant story. I think a lot of us in North America do. But do you think that this, and I hate to use the word, well, I don't, I mean, this is a Catholic program after all, but the word exodus, like there's something about our human condition that I think, like we're a people on a move, like we're, some would say we're on our way to heaven. Like there's something very personal or visceral about the refugee story. What would you say to that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that we find truth and we find meaning in something or someone or some story that's related to this. For me, you know, I'm somebody who believes in just our collective humanity and that fundamentally we are on a path to yielding something correct and something that will look after our fellow neighbor. This is something where, you know, Father Mike Lopez and I, we really bonded. You know, he's a wonderful guy. And I think the faith communities in general really stepped up to help support these people because it is written into the DNA of every religion that I've come in contact with is the simple act of feeding thy neighbor, looking out for your common person and being there as an entity for good. And I think that I found a lot of power in, again, the volunteers. I found a lot of power in the migrants themselves for staying positive and really believing that their journey is righteous, that they're on a path to a place, and one way or another, it's the right choice. And, you know, adelante, they always said, like, you know, adelante, adelante, we're moving forward. We have to keep going. And they find a lot of power in their faith. I find a lot of power in them. So I think that, you know, it is one of the great positives of religion and of faith and spirituality in general, is this belief in collectively watching out for one another. And I find it really inspiring.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Father Mike Lopez. We're still hoping to try to connect with him and feature all the good work that he's doing. He's featured in your film. Maybe one last word. Why Roads of Fire?
Well, it's a great question. I think that everyone walks a different path, but it's a path that, while distinct and while different, there is a commonality to the struggle, the collective struggle. Whether it's you're an Afghan teenager fleeing Taliban, whether you're an older, you know, father, an imam, a deacon, whether you're a school teacher from Venezuela, everybody that I encountered had these shared stories that were just so extreme that it felt like walking through fire. Every one of these conversations was this feeling of, we are traversing something that's so extreme you can't even imagine it. And so for me, it became this a really evocative way of communicating that all of these people, they're coming to our shores after having walked through hell. So what can we do for them?
Yeah. You know, it's a great title, but it's more than just a great title. It's a great story and an important one. So thank you for making the film and for helping us think through these big thoughts today. Thank you, Nathaniel.
Mm-hmm. Deacon, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Nathaniel Lezra is the director and executive producer of Roads of Fire. You can find out more and where to watch the film at roadsoffiredoc.com. And the film will be on all platforms starting on January 6th.
Hi, I'm Father Bill Quinlivan. I'm a priest of the Diocese of Buffalo, New York. And you are listening to the Salt and Light Hour with Deacon Pedro.
Find out everything you need to know about Salt and Light Media and how to support our ministry at slmedia.org. And now it's time for Book Ends with Germaine Bagnall. Germaine, welcome back to the Salt and Light Hour.
Always an absolute pleasure to be here to chat about books and chat with you.
I've been having a little book withdrawal. It's like, not that I don't have books, but I don't have a lot of good book suggestions. It's just sort of books that get thrown at me. So I'm looking forward to what you have to suggest, especially as we go into the Advent and Christmas season.
Yes, it's, you know, as the one liturgical year closes, another one is beginning. It's always nice to share the reads, particularly when we get around to Christmas time, if you want to get something for your loved ones, for the young and the young at heart, as I always like to cover two books.
Yep.
So the first one will be for the young. This is called The Road to Bethlehem. It's by Brian Wildsmith. I hope I pronounced that correctly. It's from the Sophia Institute Press. And this is a beautiful, colorful children's book that is a bit of a fresh take on the birth of Jesus, a bit of a change of perspective on the nativity.
Okay.
Yeah. So the whole idea of the book, the beginning is Angel Gabriel comes to meet Mary to say she's going to be with child. And this is the part of the story that we're used to, beautifully illustrated, very rich in color. I'm actually at a bit of a loss of words to how to fully describe it. It's just like a work of art. It's just beautifully done. But I digress. And the story, you know, Joseph and Mary, they saddle up and they head off to Bethlehem. And you would think that the story is going to be all about their journey to Bethlehem, but that's not the case. What actually the story actually gets centered on their dog and cat that get left behind. Oh. You know, I miss that. I miss that piece of scripture.
That's
about
not
their,
scripture.
Their little dog.
I don't know.
And they head off, and then it's all about this dog and cat that love and miss Mary very much. So they run off to go find her. And it's just a little bit of their journey and their encounters across the way as they help fellow animals. You know, there's a little fox that's in distress, and they help out the little fox. And he's like, hey, can I come too? And it's like, yeah, come on, follow us. They go along some more. They meet a bear, help them. And along the way, they encounter three camels who they invite to come with them to their journey. And they're like, hey, we have to wait for our masters. Hopefully we'll see you.
Ooh, who owns those camels?
Exactly, exactly. When I came across that, I actually broke out into a smile. I was like, that's really cute. And, you know, then it ends and leads to the nativity, the birth of our Lord Jesus.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful entry point, I think, for children to be a witness to Jesus, to learn about the importance of his birth, and not just for every man, woman, and child, but even for the animals, you know, and they kind of get this added sort of association with Jesus, with the nativity, because even the last bit of art is almost that classic nativity, but now there's this added sense of
all the animals,
the animals that are here, they really journeyed, they wanted to be a witness to this too. So it's really cute. It's really cute, very well done. And I think it's great for the young, for sure.
Okay, good. So The Road to Bethlehem, Brian Wildsmith by Sophia Institute Press. And would you say that this is so it's a beautiful art, but is it for little kids, or is it for older?
I would say little kids, you know, your preschoolers, your kindergartners, grade one, you know, this is part of the catechumen, I would say.
Okay. Sounds good. I always look forward to reading little books or Christmas related stories with my children, during Advent. Mm. So maybe this is one that people can adopt for that purpose. And then you have a book for the young at heart.
For the young at heart. And instead of the heart, this one will move up a little bit and focus on your noggin.
Young at brain.
Yes. So this book is called Change Your Brain, Change Your Life.
Okay.
By Dr. Daniel G. Amen.
Okay.
And it's really all about brain health. I came across this book. Actually, it was recommended to me by a colleague. She has a deep fascination with just learning about people and just how people function. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, you know what, let me check this out. And it really talks about how our brains function, brain health, things like that. For myself, there was an added curiosity. I'm late diagnosed with what used to be called ADD, but it's actually ADHD, primarily inattentive. For those who know me, they will be like, well, yeah, how did you not know that?
Welcome to the club.
Yeah. Well, you know, I found media, we are overly represented, but it's part of our curiosity, how we
it
function.
It is.
But I really enjoyed learning a bit more about myself on like simple things of like diet, of, you know, what I should eat first thing in the morning, what will help me perform the best, how I can function through my day to day, and how I can organize things. And I would say, you know, we do need to take care of our corporeal needs as Catholics, as Christians. And this is a very important thing for that longevity, for our overall health, but also for those who are neurodiverse. This, to me, can help with one's faith. So learning about how I function really influences my prayer life, on how I actually can organize it, you know, of how or when to do the rosary, or if you want to get into, you know, doing things throughout the day for prayer and things like that. And I think there's great value in that, and just understanding your mind, how you function, because how you function will impact a lot of different things. And maybe this even, it can help people understand their propensity, perhaps even for certain vices or sins that they may be locked into.
Right.
And you could realize, oh, if I can get healthy in this area, I can then be healthy in this other area.
Okay.
So, yeah, this is just kind of my perspective on how we can sort of look at our overall well-being, you know.
I like that. So it's not just how diet affects their brain, but all like your whole lifestyle affects, like even when you pray or how much you meditate or when you go for walks, things like that. So your lifestyle.
Exactly. And the book doesn't speak to the spiritual side, although he, to my understanding, Dr. Amen is Christian, which is a great last name also.
Yes.
Me extrapolating that to how I live. And this is what it is to be Catholic. It's the universal, like all of us, but it's also our universal, like self, mind, body, soul.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I like your point that, yeah, we take care of our spiritual life, but that doesn't mean that we neglect our physical, our corporal, our bodies. Yeah. Okay, so that
precisely there's a heresy in there. I think so.
So change your brain, change your life, Dr. Daniel G. Amen, and it's published by Harmony. And then the first book you mentioned, Road to Bethlehem, published by Sophia Institute Press. Okay, great. Some good suggestions there as people. Let's think about stocking stuffers, a little book for your stocking. Thank you, Jermaine. It's good to see you, and have a blessed Advent journey to Bethlehem with the animals.
And to you too.
Thank you so much. Jermaine Bagnall is the founder and head of content at 70 Media. You can follow him at Jermaine Bagnall. Coming up in our second half hour, a conversation with our featured artist, Gabriel Jamaria. So don't go anywhere. Welcome to the Salt and Light Hour Part 2. I'm Deacon Pedro.
Some friends of mine, the Sisters Poor of Jesus Christ, they have a mission house here in Hamilton that serve the poor, and got to know them, and we've, you know, done street ministry with them, and they are also musicians, and they would, you know, inspire me by telling me about all these other Catholic artists like Sarah Kroger, Matt Maher, and I said, oh wow, okay, these are really great artists, you know, playing music, sharing their faith. So that kind of inspired me to start writing and sharing my faith as well.
That's our featured artist of the week, Gabriel Jamaria from Hamilton, Ontario, who's going to be with us in a few minutes. He's going to tell us about an experience that he had as a kid with an image of Jesus. But before that, some music. Here's Gabriel Jamaria with The Right Words from his new album, As I Wait.
All these words fill my head, trying to say what can't be said. I've been proud, scattered in my thoughts. What could I say to you that you don't already know? The servant can't know more than the king, but over again I still say the same old things, yet you never die. Of your love. Sometimes I think I know what you want to hear from me, so I build up these walls of endless words. Nothing I could ever give. It's not the sacrifice I make, but from a humble, broken heart you will not turn. And over again I stand. of your love.
That was Gabriel Jamaria with The Right Words from his album, As I Wait. Gabriel Jamaria is a multi-instrumentalist and original artist from Hamilton, Ontario, who began playing music at the age of 5 with his family choir at church. Gabriel has performed all over North America and has opened for pretty big Canadian rock stars like Kim Mitchell and Trooper. His new album is titled As I Wait, and it's mainly about faith. And he says it's a nod to his Catholic roots and also to the man he strives to be. I spoke with Gabriel Jamaria earlier this week.
Gabriel, welcome to the Salt and Light Hour. It's really good to meet you.
Thank you so much, Deacon Pedro. Great to meet you as well.
So I should say that to our listeners, just before we started, so Gabriel was schooling me on how to pronounce his last name, Jamaria.
Jamaria, yeah, Italian pronunciation, but Jamaria works. Yeah, that's
Jamaria.
Great.
Do I have to do the hand signal when I say Jamaria?
Oh, yeah, the hand as well. Yeah, for sure, yeah.
I can't say your name without the hand.
Yeah.
Jamaria, so obviously Italian background.
Yes, yeah.
But born in Canada?
Yeah, born in Canada, second generation here. Both sets of my grandparents all came from Italy, and
I
have my one nonna. She lives right around the corner from me here. So, very, very close family. So it's very nice.
Oh, it's good. So lots of family nearby.
Yeah, most of us are in Hamilton. Actually, I have some relatives out in Vancouver, and then some relatives still in Italy. But a lot of people settled in here in Hamilton. So Hamilton, Ontario.
And I guess, I mean, the stereotype is that, you know, Italian family, lots of gatherings, lots of food.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Was it a big family? Like, do you have brothers and sisters?
I only have one older sister, but we still get together often, and cousins, we all live close by, and a lot of us are close in age too. So yeah, we see each other all the time. Like, we have a pizza oven here in our backyard, so we'll have nice big family gatherings. And
obviously also Italian family, a very Catholic family.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I was very blessed to grow up in a Catholic household, and yeah, like for music wise, started singing and my family choir at church before I could even read. Like, my dad would play guitar, and you know, my sister sang, my mom sang with her own choir as well, and yeah, like, so I'd memorize the songs, and then we'd go sing at mass. So it was really beautiful.
Okay, so you're both, you and your sister, like the whole family would sing at mass.
We would sing at mass. Yeah, my parents, they met in a high school band actually, so music's always been something that's been a part of our family for a long time. And yeah, my sister's 4 years older than me, so she started before I did. And then once I could kind of start singing, my dad got me singing as well and playing at mass. So,
and was the music, I mean, sounds like it was just a normal thing, or did your parents make you take music lessons?
We did take music lessons, but it kind of came from us as well. Like, you know, they gave us the opportunities, and they saw that we had the desire to continue as well. So they encouraged us along the path of music.
So, and did you, so, cause you're mainly, can I say that you're mainly a drummer?
Yeah, mainly drummer and singer, I guess. That's what I do.
Yeah.
When I play shows, that's what I do most. Cause I'm, you know, a musician for hire as well as with my own music. And so I get to do a lot of drumming shows. So some guitar as well and some other things, but yeah, drumming and singing are the two main.
So where was drumming, like, I can imagine you as a 5-year-old saying like, I want to learn how to play the drums, or were you interested in other instruments? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was 5 years old, and yeah, I think my uncle had a drum kit in their house, and I was playing. My dad said, "Okay, right." So they got me into drum lessons and got me a little drum kit, and just kept playing and practicing and going from there.
Mm-hmm. And then picking up other instruments along the way.
Yeah. I think grade 7, I started learning guitar and bass, and then a little bit of piano and stuff as well. But Yeah, and yeah, drums and singing started when I was really young, and that's been the two primary instruments for throughout.
And outside of church, did the family ever perform as a family together?
Not too much. I think we did maybe a few things like at some retirement home communities, stuff like that.
Okay.
But yeah, not, I'm trying to think, not too much. It was typically at Mass.
Yeah.
We'd play, yeah.
Yeah. And so, and were you outside of Mass then also, maybe I can imagine in high school, were you also like having a band with your friends?
Yeah. Yeah. I think
garage band.
Yeah, the first band I think I had, I was in grade 8, and we played a show in Hamilton, and
oh yeah,
then yeah, just and yeah, like kept playing and with different bands as time went on, and then eventually went to Los Angeles after I graduated high school for a year of schooling down there for music. Came back home to Humber College in Toronto and did a degree in music there, and yeah, just kind of kept going that way.
Yeah, so you knew always growing up that music was going to be your career path.
Yeah, I felt called to that in a certain way. Just remember when I was really young, just praying. I think it was in my parents' room. I was a little kid, like, you know, I always used to wake up in the middle of the night, go to my parents' bed, right, wake up in the morning there, and I remember just waking up and praying. And we had this actually this picture here. It's Jesus with a little boy. I remember seeing that when I was younger and just kind of praying and felt this call in my heart from Jesus saying, you know, make people happy. And that's just been my life mission. And I felt music has been one of the best ways that I can do that.
Interesting. So the music to make people happy, and I presume because it makes you happy.
Yes. It does. It for sure. Yeah.
And when did you start composing your own songs or writing your own music?
I've done songwriting for a number of years, but it kind of got more faith-based maybe just a couple of years ago when I had written my first song, Give to You. That kind of came just out of like prayer and kind of in discernment, you know, just kind of trying to find the path that God wants me to follow. And a lot of the inspiration came from some friends of mine, the Sisters Poor of Jesus Christ. They're they have mm-hmm. a mission house here in Hamilton that serve the poor, and got to know them. And we've, you know, done street ministry with them, and they are also musicians, and they would, you know, inspire me by telling me about all these other Catholic artists like Sarah Kroger, Matt Maher. And I said, oh, wow, okay, these are really great artists, you know, playing music, sharing their faith. So that kind of inspired me to start writing and sharing my faith as well.
Good for them.
Yeah, yeah, so absolutely.
Were you always involved in the church? Did you not go through like a teenage period of straying away?
Not too much. Like it's different stages of my life, I actually just kind of got a little bit deeper, you know, at different points. Like when I moved to Los Angeles, yep. I was living alone and I didn't know anybody there. So that was kind of a big step in my faith journey, because then I just started going to Mass every day because I had nothing to do, nobody to really go see. So that was a part of my daily routine. I'd go to Mass, then go to school. And then afterwards, wow. When I came back home here, I started to meet like Catholic young adults, the young adult community. And that was a whole other step in my faith journey as well, just being able to relate to people on a whole different level. And we can all encourage each other just in our journey of faith, which has been really helpful.
That's really interesting and surprising, because I know that the industry, like if you're in music, especially if you're mm-hmm. doing all these secular gigs and I mean, you were all over North America playing with all kinds of different bands.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But I'm sure that the world that you were exposed to was not necessarily the most, you know, uplifting Catholic
faith-based
world, right?
Yeah, I mean, not always the holiest of places, I guess we'll say, but you can still find holiness in the midst of where you are. And I've been blessed, you know, God has helped me with that, and just even surrounding me with people that are supportive of me in that way, right? I play on the road with a number of different bands, and, you know, we'll be in different states at different times, and I'll just say, hey, you know, can I take the car to go to Mass? They say, yeah, no problem, right? They're all very kind and respectful of that, which is really nice, so...
Yeah, it's funny. That has been my experience too. My background is theater.
Okay,
and
nice.
Sometimes the most supportive people of my faith and what I do as a deacon and all that, mm-hmm. and working at Salt and Light, are the people who are not Catholic, who are not faith,
wow.
who have no faith. They're all people in the industry. That's really interesting to hear. So, mm-hmm. So then you'd be on the road playing with a band, and like on a Sunday morning after playing all night Saturday night, you'd be like, hey, can I borrow the car? And
yeah,
go
pretty
to
much.
Mass?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because we'd have like we'll have some rental vans or something, and so I'll just, you know, and they know. Like sometimes they'll just be like, they came outside and the van wasn't there. They were like, where is it? Wait, they're like, oh no, it's Sunday. Gabriel's at Mass. So, you know, that's okay. They figured it out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so good friends.
You're listening to the Salt and Light Hour. I'm Deacon Pedro, and we're speaking with our featured artist of the week, Gabriel Jamaria. He's a professional musician that tours with various bands. And so I asked him, what was one performance that really stood out for him?
You know what? Actually, I think one comes to mind last year. So I play with this, sub-in with this Eagles tribute band called Hotel California. And we got to play Massey Hall in Toronto. So that was a really cool experience to play that stage and that theater there. That was a lot of fun.
Is it? I mean, I've heard so many. I've been to Massey Hall, and it is. So for people who are not familiar with Massey Hall, this is like probably the prime music hall, I'd say, in Canada.
Yeah, definitely. I think so. Yeah.
Definitely in Ontario. It's this beautiful music hall. And everybody talks about performing at Massey Hall. So, so one thing is to sit in the audience and listen to a concert there. But as a musician, is it really like the acoustics
Yeah, like everything. It was just really cool. Just a cool venue, right? Like, you know, the three tiers, right? And you go out there and it seems like it's just designed so well for a music venue, right? And it was really cool. You go downstairs, you see all the posters of these people that have played there, Robert Plant and all these artists. It's just like, wow, like this is pretty cool. So.
Everybody. Yeah. So an Eagles cover band.
Yes, an Eagles tribute band. Yeah, I play with a number of tribute bands. Yeah. Paul McCartney tribute band I play with as well. And
really?
Yeah, so called All McCartney Live. And yeah, it's been really cool to, you know, play these old classic tunes, which actually I grew up on. I lived listening to classic rock growing up and a whole bunch of different genres. So, and it's now a lot of fun to be able to play those songs.
Yeah, that's fun. And when you're playing with these bands, you're drumming mostly?
Yeah, singing? Drumming with these bands. Yeah, drumming and singing.
Singing, eh? So, so you're that's great. What a great experience, and what an experience to have the support of your bandmates.
Yeah,
don't think that you're some weirdo or who are trying to shove cannabis down your throat. Or
yeah,
something.
No, they're all really good. Like they respect me. You know, we have sometimes really great lively conversations about faith and different beliefs too, which has been really cool to have. So.
So with your songwriting, you said that it's recently that you started, I guess you felt that you needed to write about your faith experience. Did something change or is it just like where you are in your life?
Yeah, it just kind of started coming naturally because like other songs, you know, songwriting, I didn't really have much to write about. I find for me personally, when I write songs, it's only kind of write if I feel like maybe I have something to say or something on my mind. And the songs that came out of this EP, As I Wait, were all kind of just different prayers and reflections that I've, you know, had just experiencing just in my journey of faith and thought, hey, maybe, you know, I can kind of write these down. Like literally a lot of the times the lyrics would come through in prayer or adoration or things like that. So felt I should kind of share these in the hope that it might be able to relate to others as well.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. So far we played No More at the beginning of the show. Mm-hmm. And then just before you came on, we played The Right Word. So those two songs, I mean, No More is about going to confession.
Yeah, that one, I mean, just had some great priests just really encourage the sacrament of confession in just such a merciful way. And just realizing what a grace it is to be able to go to confession and not only, you know, to better ourselves and work in virtue, but no matter how many times I fall, he's always right back there to pick me up and, you know, tried to use some different biblical things as well. Like when I think I used the line, go and sin no more from the woman who, after, you know, all the accusers had left her and she said, neither do I accuse you, now go and sin no more. So that's just been something that I thought I wanted to just share the experience of God's mercy that I felt through that great sacrament of confession.
Right. And then The Right Words. Yeah. So No More is the title of the song. Mm-hmm, and that comes back to go and sin no more.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then The Right Words is about adoration or the experience of being in adoration.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of the inspiration for that one came from the story of St. Thomas Aquinas, where at the end of his life, when he had, you know, he was writing his Summa Theologica, but then he had that experience, that ecstasy with God. Right. And then after, like he said, you know, I will have nothing if not you, Lord, right? And then after that, he stopped writing the Summa because he's like, my words are like straw, nothing compared to God's greatness. So that's kind of how that inspired me. It's just like, wow, yeah, I say all these things in adoration all the time, but it's just like nothing compares to the greatness of God. He still wants to hear from us for sure, but just led me to realize how much God really speaks in the silence. And just in the silence, so much can be said. And I'm still trying to understand that and practice that, but that's where that song came from.
Yeah, I kept thinking about that, listening to it as well, that so much in so often in adoration, I'm just like trying to fill the space. Like I need to say things. And then it's like, can I just sit here and be in a state of adoration without saying anything? And it's not a natural, like it doesn't come naturally.
Yeah. Yeah. I know it's tough sometimes, but yeah, it's funny. I was talking with a sister the other day and we were talking about, I mean, sometimes somebody that we're really familiar with, we can just sit in silence, right? And enjoy each other's company, not have to say anything. So I'm like, you know what, I should try to practice that with God, because maybe sometimes I expect, okay, if there's silence, so he can talk to me and I can hear what has to happen. But maybe he just wants to just sit and be with me, and I should want to sit and be with him. So that's something I'm trying to put into practice.
Yeah, that's a beautiful image. Do you play, do you still play at church?
Yes, I do. Not as often. Like I do other ministry at Mass, because then when I moved away to Los Angeles, we kind of lost our time slot that we played at Mass, but I'll still fill in whenever I can. And I still love playing at Mass.
And you don't feel, not that you have to, but you don't feel called to do like, to lead worship or to be like a quote unquote Christian artist?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to figure out right now. Like seeing, you know, these songs, where's a space that I could share these songs if people are interested in hearing them. Like I had played an EP release show at a cafe and wine bar a couple of weeks ago. And it was really, it was a lot of fun. You know, I kind of called it Faith and Favorites. I played some of the songs from the EP, and then just other classic songs too, that I could maybe relate to on a deeper level. And it was a really great night. So yeah, I'm just trying to find, you know, just trying to see where God, if he wants me to share these songs, where or how I could share them, whether it be as a worship leader or just some other, you know, maybe different church events or something else. I'm just kind of open to see where that could be shared.
Yeah. So discernment, I guess. That's a good thing to discern. So the last song that we're going to play is called Give to You, which is about discernment.
Yes.
So can you give us a little introduction to this song, Give to You?
Yeah. So this was the first faith-based song that I wrote, and it came pretty naturally. Just where I was and still, you know, really trying to find what that path is. And even in the uncertainty, you know, we always maybe look to the vocation of, you know, marriage, holy orders, what is it? But that we, you know, just being taught that the first primary vocation is to holiness. So day by day, whatever we're doing, can I give myself to God with what he's given me here and now? I want to give all to him in this moment.
Yeah, that's a good lesson for all of us. A good reminder. I think it's something that we all kind of know because we've been told, but we tend to forget.
Yeah, I do all the time, but exactly. Yeah,
all the time. Well, thank you for writing about that to remind us. Gabriel, it's been really good meeting you. Thanks for reaching out.
Great to meet you, Deacon Pedro. Thank you so much.
And maybe someone's listening and they need an instrumentalist or a drummer or someone to join their worship band. That would be great.
Yes, for sure.
I'm sure that God will let you know at the right time where you need to go with the gifts he has given you. And thank you for sharing those gifts with us today.
Thank you so much. Thank you for all that you guys do at Salt and Light and for sharing this as well. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Good. Stay in touch.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Deacon Pedro.
You can learn more about Gabriel Jamaria and purchase his music at his website, gabrieljamaria.com. And it's Jam Maria with a double M, gabrieljamaria.com. And also you can find him on your social media and wherever you stream music. Here now is Gabriel Jamaria with Give to You from his new album, As I Wait.
Little did I know what you want from me and what I should let go. But still you hold me close. Though the world will fall, your words are still my home. And my thoughts are racing, 'cause I keep chasing all these empty dreams, till the day I finally turn my head and hear your dreams for me. 'Cause I couldn't run, I couldn't hide, anywhere your love won't find. You know my wrongs, you know what's right, you turn my darkness into light. In all that I am, in all that I do, everything I have, Lord, I give to you. I thought I heard a voice, but I
We're listening to Gabriel Jamaria with Give to You from his new album, As I Wait. And that will take us to the end of the program this week. The best place to listen to the Salt and Light Hour and watch Salt and Light TV live and on demand is on the Salt and Light Plus app. Be sure to download it and take us with you wherever you go. Today, let's continue to pray for peace in the world. Let's pray for a fair resolution to the war in Ukraine, for Gaza and the West Bank, for Nigeria, for those young people that have been taken hostage. Let's pray for migrants, refugees, and displaced people everywhere, and for all those who do so much to help them. Let's also pray for all those struggling with discernment or with confession or adoration, that the Lord will grant them the graces that they need. And I pray for you, our dear listeners, as we begin the season of Advent, may you have a blessed journey to Bethlehem. Thank you for being with me today. I pray that this program has blessed you. I hope that you had a blessed Thanksgiving weekend. Let's not forget how fortunate we are and never forget those who are not as fortunate as we are. I'm Deacon Pedro, and this has been the Salt and Light Hour.